Good afternoon, and welcome to today's episode of the Migration and Diaspora Podcast, a podcast where we discuss all things related to migration, with me, your host, Loxanne Harley. I was very excited to be joined for today's episode by Leon Isaacs, CEO of Developing Markets Associates, DMA, which is a specialist international development company that he founded in 2007. Leon is a seasoned expert and business leader in the payments and international development fields, with a particular expertise in migrant remittances. During the course of his 30-year career, Leon was managing director of the International Association of Money Transfer Networks. He served as a member of the UK government's remittances task force, and he is an observer to the G20 Consultative Committee of the Private-Public Sector Partnership on Remittances. Leon has spoken at and chaired numerous international conferences on remittances, including at the World Bank, the United Nations, and the G8. He has also been involved in two successful startup remittance businesses. He's an economist by training and currently based in France, and he joined us from his home in sunny Provence, of which I was very jealous. Leon is someone I respectfully refer to as Mr. Remittances when talking about him. He really lives and breathes the topic. He's also one of the best communicators I know, with an incredible ability to explain technical issues in an accessible and engaging way. His blend of public and private sector experiences also gives him a unique and very practical perspective. I was delighted to get him on the show because remittances are such a critical aspect of how migration and migrants contribute to development. Consciousness of remittances and their importance has grown in recent years, so much so that they have their dedicated Sustainable Development Goal target 10C, which is to reduce to less than 3% transaction costs of migrant remittances. In our wide-ranging conversation, we talk about both the big picture and learnings from Leon and DMA's recent work, including how COVID has impacted remittances, the key remittances challenges facing small and fragile states, diaspora investment, and some of the impacts of new technology. We close with Leon's take on the three things we need to focus on in order to achieve that target 10C. And of course, we managed to slip in a bit of banter about football, since Leon is a passionate fan of Watford Football Club. Well, no one is perfect. Without further ado, thank you very much for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the interview. Leon Isaacs, welcome to the Migration Podcast. How are you doing?
Hi, Loxanne. I'm doing extremely well, thank you, under all the circumstances.
And where are you joining us from?
I'm joining you, the part of the reason why I'm doing well, I'm joining you from the northern part of Provence in the south of France. It's a beautiful sunny day, and I think we've had 2 days of rain in the last 2 months, so I'm generally looking quite cheery and enjoying life down here.
Very jealous. I am in the south of England, as you know, where it's actually sunny right now, but that is not the norm, and I've just come back from my summer holidays in Ireland. And I must say, actually, in Ireland, I met our mutual friend, Martin Russell, and he told me something quite interesting about the first time you met. He explained that the first time you met, one memory he has is seeing, I think either seeing or hearing you talk about a mug that you have. And the mug was the CFAX page that celebrated Watford getting promoted into the Premier League. And well, beyond just talking about that, because it sounds like a great mug, and since football is a cross-cutting issue of this podcast, I just wanted to say, given that Watford has now been relegated from the Premier League, are you going to get any sort of memorabilia to commiserate that occasion?
If there's any available, I definitely will. Thanks for bringing that up so early, I have to say. And I remember that well. And yeah, I've dined out a lot on our promotion. So I'm not sure if they're going to produce any memorabilia, but I've already ordered my shirt for next season, which looks more like something you'd wear on a surfboard than on a football pitch, to be honest. But I've definitely ordered one of those, and I've also ordered one for one of my friends from the remittances industry who lives overseas and has become a Watford fan as a result of meeting me. So I feel that's my duty. And also, I'm not so disappointed we got relegated. If I'm perfectly honest, the way we played, we deserved to get relegated. And now we can get to play our local rivals, Luton, next year, which we probably haven't done for 10 years. So football's not so bad. And just to add one final point, my second team is now Paris Saint-Germain because we lived very close to them when we lived in Paris. So I'm looking forward to the Champions League final on Sunday anyway as well.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I guess you've got more chance of seeing some trophies with that team.
yeah.
Okay, well, to move on. So what does DMA do and what inspired you to found it? You know, and to move into the field of international development after quite a long career working for financial services providers, including money transfer operators?
Yeah, good question. So to answer the first part, which is probably a bit easier about what we do, we're a specialist development consultancy. We're a private sector organisation. And we specialise primarily in remittances, some diaspora investment and diaspora engagement, and then also some financial literacy training as well. And we're anything and everything to do with remittances. But most of our clients are public sector bodies in the international organizations, the World Bank, United Nations, and so on, the EU, a lot of governments. And then we do an occasional bit of work for the private sector, partially so we can keep our hand in to know what's going on, but also because we sort of often fill the gap between what the international development organizations think they want from remittances and what the private sector operators are actually trying to do. And we're trying to explain each other to both of those, which seems like they should know, but generally I find that they don't understand how each other thinks very well. So we do a lot of work trying to bridge that gap. And I guess I got into this primarily because, as you said, I worked for a long time in the private sector. In about 2005, we were doing a lot of work with DFID in the UK on remittances, and the general principles for international remittances was being developed by the World Bank and the Bank for International Settlements, and they asked for some private sector input. So it was an area I didn't know at all, and I worked alongside these guys, and then I realised, actually, this world is going to change. And actually, rather than being a company that just pumps product and basically is always driven by the bottom line, it looked more interesting on the other side of the fence, really, in trying to help develop policies that would really change people's lives rather than just the shareholders of the businesses. So that was sort of why I got into it. I think it was also just at that time when remittances was moving from a duopoly between Western Union and MoneyGram to a lot of other players. Digital payments were just being talked about. So there was a lot of change happening. And instead of staying doing what I was doing, I really had reached that point where I needed a new challenge. So formed DMAG and I've never looked back, I suppose, as they say.
Fantastic. And I think that, I mean, that blend of private and public sector experiences just must give you some brilliant insights into the remittances field and into the possible ways forward to address the issues that we're going to talk about today. And, you know, I guess this question precedes the last one, but, you know, since this is the Migration Podcast, could you perhaps give us a quick overview of what remittances are for those who may not know and how they relate to migration?
Okay, so remittances, I guess, is generally referred to as one of the good news or positive elements around migration. that may be an exaggeration for many, but ultimately they are the money. As we know, around 90% of migrants move for economic or financial reasons, basically to better their lives and their family lives. And remittances is actually the amount of money they send back home to their country of origin, nearly always to their immediate family members, for a mixture of purposes, whether it's initially consumption, food, clothes, and so on. Then they generally move on to schooling, health, and so on. And then ultimately, they start moving on to cash or funds generating businesses, say, where they use the savings or the surplus to invest or to start a business and so on. And these are typically small amounts of money individually. We're talking $200-$300 at a time. In fact, I think the global average is just over $300, but sent regularly, so probably once a month or six times a year. But cumulatively, last year they came to $714 billion globally. So if you put that into the context of overseas development assistance or something, they're probably three or four times that level. So they're personal payments. They're nothing to do with governments or anything. And it's money that's sent home by migrants to their family to help improve their livelihood one way or another.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And before we dig into some of your recent projects, I'd like to start with that big picture. And I'd like to get your take on what are the big preoccupations of the remittances world at the moment. You know, what should we be worried about or concerned about or thinking about more?
Well, it's a good question, particularly as we're, 6 months into the COVID pandemic. So that's clearly one of the big things. But perhaps to take a step back, the remittances world, governments have woken up to these flows of funds that are being made from one person to another person. And one of the big problems is that they are expensive, they're generally inefficient, and often they don't get to very easily to the, particularly to rural areas where they need to get to. So, you know, typically if I'm sending $200 or $300, $200 at the moment is going to cost me something over $13 to send that on average. And if you think of what a recipient in a developing country could do with that $13 on a monthly basis, it's quite a significant amount. So the UN has a global target to reduce the current price to 3%. So instead of $13, it should be no more than $6 for that type of payment. I think because of the way remittances work, they're largely cash dominated. So people pay in cash and they collect in cash. And the problem with that is you need lots of different organizations or entities involved in the payment process, which automatically makes it expensive. And then the other thing is, because it's a financial product, many countries have rules and regulations that handle, you know, anti-money laundering, counter-terrorist financing, which is obviously very sensible, but they apply the same approach to send a small amount as $1 million, which doesn't help. And they also restrict the types of businesses that can offer this service to financial services. And we know banks in particular, in many countries, bank branches, there's a lot closing anyway, but even those that are open, they're not open in the rural areas. They're only open in the main center. So in many developing countries where there's more than half the people are in rural areas, they really can't get the money that's being sent to them very easily either. They might have to take a day off work, spend a lot of money on a bus to get there and so on. So those are the types of issues that we're focusing on. And then COVID has come along and made it even sort of more pressing, but also harder to be able to operate. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, that's a really helpful and insightful overview of the big picture. And I definitely want to get into COVID because I know you've done research on it and it's very current and very relevant. But I did want to quickly ask, you know, given your, you know, I'm not going to guess your age, Leon, but I think you, since you've been in the world, in the business for a while, I wanted to get your perspective on to what extent have those key issues changed over time. I mean, presumably the magnitude of them is changing, and that technology has increased competition in the remittance markets, and
you know, removed the number of entities involved in that chain and therefore helped reduce costs. But are we still talking about the same issues, fundamentally the same issues as we were, you know, 10, 20 years ago?
Well, back to my age, I'm probably one of the few people alive who was born before England last won the World Cup, if that gives you a clue. So that's a long time ago. But I think in terms of the issues, I mean, I think most of those issues, it'd be fair to say, have been around, particularly the pricing and improving how things work. They've been around for over 10 years now. Not 20, I'd say 10 years. International consciousness about remittances started in 2004, really. And in 2009, the G8 and then the G20 set global targets for the price of remittances. So that's when that happened. I think the whole digitization and improvement of businesses came just after that. So, you know, some of the household names, for me anyway, probably not for many listeners, but in the remittances world, WorldRemit, Azimo, Zoom, these types of companies have now been around for over 10 years. So they're really aimed at digitizing the process to an extent. I think what's happened is there's now more emphasis on setting and achieving proper targets and also putting some resource and oomph behind that as well. So the issues are broadly the same. The solutions are slightly different. But unfortunately, there's still a massive way to go. And, you know, just to illustrate that, maybe I mentioned before about cash being one of the major challenges with this business. Before COVID, it was estimated that around 90% of transactions were going via cash. Now, since COVID, that's probably gone down a bit, and we can get into the whys and wherefores. But that might be at, say, 80 to 85% now. So that's still a massive issue that we've got roughly the same issues, but we're not making fast enough progress in many of the areas.
Okay, great. And well, we'll definitely dig into some of those issues you just touched on in a bit. And I wanted to come back to COVID, though. And you, of course, just alluded to that, to one of the impacts. And the question is, you know, you've been doing some work on the impact of COVID on remittances. So could you perhaps elaborate what has the impact been? How has COVID affected remittances?
Yeah, I mean, well, the first thing I would say is, and probably a bit like a lot of the migration world, it's difficult to get really accurate data on a global basis. But from the work we've been doing, I think the first thing to say is the World Bank, almost straight after most of the shutdowns happened, came out and predicted that remittance volumes would fall by 20% in this year. And really that means $140, $150 billion fall. And that's mainly driven by the fact that many migrants were in danger, were either working in industries that were not allowed to operate. So if they were lucky, they were furloughed, but quite often they lost their jobs. You know, thinking of hospitality, transport, a lot of the building works. If you look around the world, a lot of the migrants have lost their jobs. Those who've retained them probably are making sure, probably don't have, as they would have had a break anyway, so they've had to use some of their savings. And I think the fact that people can't travel is probably the biggest challenge, because in previous crises, you know, they were normally much more localized. So if I lost my job in one country, I would be able to go to another country and find a job there. And migrants are very resourceful and they will do almost anything to earn money. So the fact that people can't travel is probably the biggest danger, particularly now, you know, probably like yourself. Before the crisis, I think I was traveling, you know, a lot around Africa in particular, and inconvenient. Some of it was generally straightforward. Now you can't even begin to think about traveling anywhere. And I'm lucky I have the choice. A lot of migrants don't, but if they're not earning money, they can't send it. On top of that, you've got a lot of challenges for the money transfer operators as well, because in some countries, they were deemed to be essential services, but in most they weren't. So anybody who had a network of remittance agents they were probably having to close, so they couldn't offer services. So they also had to say, if they had a headquarters or a call center, many of the operators had to close those and send those staff home, buy them computers, get them connected to the internet so they could work remotely. So there's a lot of those, let's say, operational issues. And then even if you could work with your network on the sending side, your paying out agents in receiving countries, a lot of them were shut down as well. So even continuing to operate and then knowing what governments were allowing them to do and not allow them to do, there were so many communication problems, interpretation problems. And, you know, we've heard lots of stories of where the central government was saying it's fine, but a local police department said, oh no, we've heard this, we're going to close you down, why are you open? So there's a mixture of the market contracting and operationally it being much more difficult, and still customers really desperately want to send money. There are upsides as well to the crisis, but I think you asked me what were the challenges. So those are most of those.
Well, yeah, I mean, the big impacts. And I mean, it seems like, as you've said, people, migrants work in industry, well, in many countries, they disproportionately work in industries which have been locked down. Many work in ways that they unfortunately may not be covered by furlough schemes, or many just work in countries where they don't have furlough schemes. So plenty of negative impacts. So at least let's give us a few silver linings here. I imagine technology, cash to technology, cash to non-cash remittances, what has the impact been there?
Yeah, I think that's definitely one. Perhaps just to say before that, I think the other thing is there has been a really positive response from the international bodies and governments to the potential impact of a fall in remittances or the challenges going on. I've been really pleasantly surprised by how lots of the governments that previously had looked at remittances and done some things and have then moved away from it have now got re-engaged. And that the UN in particular has been bringing together and set up a task force to actually try and address this. So getting government commitment on a coordinated basis is important.
And just to jump in there, I mean, to what extent have we also seen diasporas, migrants supporting their communities of origin who are being devastated by coronavirus, as many countries are, through their remittances, or perhaps, you know, using, essentially sending PPE or arranging various philanthropic initiatives to provide a lifeline to communities hit by COVID?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, it's been really heartwarming seeing a lot of these cases, and because it's difficult for the migrants, you know, they're the ones who are most likely threatened with their livelihood, but they also feel this real pressure to send money. Oh, pardon me. And a lot of them have been making many, many sacrifices to do so. But as you say, either directly themselves or as part of their loose organizations, trying to send physical products, dipping into any savings or spare cash they might have to send money home, particularly in the early stages, and just trying to be as supportive as possible. It's also quite interesting that on the, even some of the receivers, if they had any spare money, some of them have been trying to send it to the senders to tide them over until their work recommences. So it's been actually a bit more of a two-way street than we might have expected. But I think one of the challenges that we've seen is how the diaspora actually probably wants to engage more and do more, particularly on specific initiatives. And they want to work with governments, but they're finding it very difficult to develop easy to implement solutions. And we've had quite a lot of discussions with people saying, look, I want to help my local hospital or whatever. I don't actually have anybody there, but I want to make sure my community is looked after. How can I do that? And, you know, some countries, it's not so difficult. You can send money directly through bill pay services to help the hospitals, but others it's very difficult because you have to go through a number of steps with government. So that's been really encouraging.
Just on that, I mean, do you have any examples of countries which have put in place initiatives which have succeeded in facilitating those transfers?
Well, as you know, we specialize mainly in the African continent, and we've seen countries where it's very much top of their mind or top of their actions, countries like Ghana and so on, where they've really tried to build on some of the efforts they were making before COVID anyway, to really harness the efforts of the diaspora to look at more investment type activities. So they've been working with diaspora groups on specific investment areas, or actually not even investment, just areas where they need money or physical support in many places. So that's one that sort of springs to mind. But there's not been, well, I won't say there's not been enough of those. They're quite difficult to put in place, as you know, and you need a lot of checks and balances. But it seems to me that Ghana has leveraged some of the work it's done before to really make a difference in this area anyway.
Okay, great. Yeah, and we're going to come back to diaspora investment in a moment, and I definitely agree with you about how Ghana has really led the way in that region in terms of not just diaspora investment, but building a stronger relationship with its many diaspora communities. I wanted to just ask though about the technological aspect. To what extent have we seen a shift, or to what extent has COVID expedited the shift from cash-based remittances to digital remittances?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think the short answer is yes, there's a definite shift. There's a shift in the way people are talking about it. You know, there's always been a lot of skepticism with the money transfer providers about whether customers really will use digital. And I think now, if you look at a public announcement from Western Union or MoneyGram or a World Remit or whatever, that's all they talk about is how many people are using their digital services. I think some of it is a bit smoke and mirrors because the traditional cash-based operators define digital as a payment that you can do, that's only at one, or digital element is only at one end of the transaction. It could be at both, but they often say that only needs to be at one. So maybe using online to pay in, but cash is still collected on the way out. So it's not a full definition, but what we've seen is a big shift. So the publicly quoted companies, which is really Western Union, MoneyGram and Ria, are now all talking about what proportion of their transactions are going digitally. And for Q1, Western Union was at 16%. So before the crisis, only about 16% of their money was going digitally at one end or both ends. MoneyGram was at 18%, and then for Q2 only, both of them had jumped up to nearly 30%, so significant increase there. It's fascinating for me because it means they're now, their agents are not going to earn as much, so it'd be interesting whether they can keep their agents if they're not earning as much.
So yeah, and that's good to hear, because especially since presumably the move to digital is one of the key ways that we're going to meet the SDGs and get remittance costs down. And I mean, it is also quite striking that sometimes, of course, many people use cash-based remittances because that's their only option. But in other cases, perhaps, you know, it's this COVID pandemic has provided that opportunity to get some of the lower hanging fruit, as it were, the ones who perhaps just needed a bit of information and a bit of a push to get familiar with digital.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the key things is it's probably it's both a push issue from the user, and then it's actually a pull issue from the operators. So because, as we said earlier, many of the agents were not able to operate, people still desperately needed to send money home. And so they were making an effort to understand what other services were available. At the same time, the money transfer operators were putting much more effort into education, awareness raising, and so on of the users. in the past. Many of them have been not particularly active in that space, but there's been a big push to try and educate people and really to build trust. Because one of the things we probably don't appreciate fully is actually that people who are sending money to Africa and Asia and Latin America and so on, one of their biggest worries is about online scams and frauds and so on. So they're really not very happy about giving what is a large sum of money to somebody they don't know and they don't really understand the process. So that trust building has really started to develop now because they've realized they don't have a choice and they've started to do it. So there's actually been a good effort from both the senders and the organizations that are sending money to provide information. I think, though, that this is one area that governments could really do a lot more to try and reassure senders and receivers, but also to use it as a really good opportunity to educate people and to bring more financial inclusion. Because ultimately, to receive money or to send money, you have to have some account-based service, whether it's a card, mobile wallet, or whatever. If you don't have some sort of account-holding mechanism, whether it's a card, a wallet, a bank account, or so on, either the sending or the receiving end or at both ends, then you're going to have to use the cash-based system at some point, which means that actually you're not getting all the benefits of being the full participant in the financial system. And to be honest, neither are the governments or the institutions. So it's in everybody's interest, as long as the financial products are affordable and useful, to get as many people included as possible. And this is where, of course, migrants have a lot of problems now, because if you're operating in the informal economy or you can't actually prove you're in the country legitimately, in many countries you can't actually get an account-based service. But I think this is because of the struggles that everybody's having because of COVID and the opportunities with digital, it is actually getting countries to look again as to whether the controls and the reasons why they're there are appropriate for these types of services anyway.
Very good point. So I guess one key point that we all need to be moving towards, especially government, is getting people digital on both ends of the transaction. Right. I'd like to talk a bit about diaspora investment. You know, it's an area that I've worked on too. And just to plug in the podcast episode with Martin Russell, where we spoke a bit about diaspora investment as well. You know, I'd like to ask you for your thoughts on this, because I think it's a topic that a lot of governments are interested in and perhaps seduced by. And I wanted to ask, you know, what are the key issues as you see them in the way that people see diaspora investment?
Okay. It's a fascinating area. I mean, I think, first of all, we've got a big definitional problem because lots of people hear the term remittances and then immediately think that that means people have got lots of money to invest in initiatives that will help that country, more sort of public sector or potentially regional initiatives. Whereas, you know, I draw a big distinction between remittances as being a person-to-person product that is primarily sent for the benefit of that family in a relatively immediate way. Whereas diaspora investment is basically applying savings or other funds as a specific investment in some sort of vehicle that is not really family run. It's normally state run or business run or something like that. So the first point I'd, you know, really encourage, particularly development professionals, is they're two completely different things. With remittances, we have to work out how to make it more efficient and how to, you know, reduce the cost, but it's basically an operational issue. Whereas with diaspora investment, it's much more about longer term initiatives that benefit both the investor, but particularly the country. So to me, they're two quite different things. And I think if you look at, so sort of to the main part of your question, for me, having looked at a lot of diaspora investment initiatives, they're exactly what you said. They're almost a way that countries look at, oh, we've got this group of people outside, they're more likely to invest in our country than other groups because there's some natural affinity. So all we've got to do is really design a few products, offer them to them, and they'll invest. which is where it all goes wrong, really. So as you probably know, we did a project last year for the African Development Bank, actually, in designing a template to help countries with their diaspora investment. And we looked at all different areas. Well, basically, they had to map where they currently were and then where they wanted to get to and what gaps needed to be filled in. But I'd say two or three things were very clear. One is most of the current diaspora investment initiatives, well, they were all different. There was no consistency and they were very poorly targeted in many ways. And they probably cost more to run than they would have raised in investment, as one. And part of the reason for that is that there was very little understanding of the diaspora and what they really wanted. You know, whether they'd even consider investing in something run by the government of the country that they're from, but actually they might have left because they didn't trust the government in the first place. But also what types of things they would want to invest, how much disposable income they would have to do it, what types of returns. Most of the initiatives around diaspora investment were driven from the supply side, from the entity, the government normally, maybe a local government, that wanted to raise money. And they designed it all with virtually no consumer research on the sending side. And so, you know, they put out a product there because they'd read about it or somebody else had done something similar. Whereas actually, you know, diaspora bonds, as a good example, people actually don't even talk about diaspora investment quite a lot now. They talk about diaspora bonds. But actually, there's probably only four countries in Africa, four or five maybe, that could issue a bond because the size of their diasporas are too small to support it. But they still wanted to investigate it because they'd seen Nigeria had successfully done it or Ethiopia or something. So there was lots of lessons. I think there's a great opportunity, but for me in diaspora investment, either at a local level in the country of origin, there are definitely some really good investment things that could be done. And that really plays into the individual migrants, really what's close to their heart. But then the other part is, why not enable diasporans to participate somehow in some of the major money market raising initiatives? Because what happens, the diaspora get very upset if a country goes to the Eurobond market, gets a lot of investment from, you know, institutional investors, but then the diaspora themselves can't participate. So why not give them a small chunk of the amount of money they're hoping to raise to build some loyalty, to then get them to support other more micro initiatives further down the line? So it's a complicated area, that's for sure.
You make some really great points there, Leon. And well, first of all, I like the way that you frame it and distinguish between, you know, remittances as being between individuals or between migrants and their families and friends and so on the one hand, and then diaspora investment being something where you're targeting a group of people are investing in certain products. You know, it's, and I feel, at least my feeling is that a lot of countries are a bit seduced by these specific engagement strategies, and that can lead to some governments sort of skipping some steps in the process. You know, a lot of governments fail to do that hard work of, you know, mapping your diaspora, getting to know your diaspora, who are they, what are they doing, where are they, and then building that trust with them, and then skipping straight ahead to these more quote unquote glamorous products, which then, you know, lose their efficacy because, as you've pointed out, diasporas might not have trust in their countries. They may have left for very good reasons and not want to put their money back in, or especially not through government-led vehicles. And then a lot of ways to increase diaspora investment could come from just removing certain barriers that have been put in place. So I totally agree with some of your points there about a lot of governments are looking at diaspora bonds while perhaps missing a trick or two on what they could do as quicker wins.
No, I think we could talk a long time about diaspora investment. I think all I would say is each country needs to develop its own solution. So completely, as you said, there's an opportunity to have consistent formats around solutions, but what the specific vehicle is and so on could vary quite a lot. And I just re-emphasize this whole research side and understanding, as you said, the mapping, absolutely essential first point. And it might be that countries need to work with their regional neighbours to be able to undertake initiatives as well, because they won't be able to attract enough, even if it's a low value scheme, they won't be able to attract enough in many cases to justify the amount of effort involved.
So moving on, I'd like to go back a bit to remittances and ask you a bit about your work that you've been doing with fragile countries and small states. How do their relationships with the remittances, the issues that they imply, differ from the norm?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a stimulating area for us, really, partially because you do have to distinguish a bit between the small states and then the fragile states. So, you know, the fragile states probably a bit more obvious for most people to understand, because generally they're either still in some sort of dire situation, whether it's war or famine or something, or they're recovering from that. So, you know, if you take the impact of Ebola in West Africa, or you take a hurricane or something like that, the issues are probably a fewfold. First is, in many cases, after, say, a natural disaster in particular, or a war situation, the diaspora are often the keenest to get money into a country, far more so that they can move much more quickly. The challenge is there's nearly always very limited infrastructure, very limited formal operators. So money still comes in, but it comes in through the informal means, which is probably also the means that if it was a conflict situation, how money was coming in then as well. So it doesn't help. So for fragile countries, a lot of work needs to be done in building the infrastructure and building the capacity within the central regulatory or market government department that's trying to build those areas. It's almost like we need a hit squad to come in and sort of do something immediately that you can do, but then really build up proper infrastructure. And given if we want people to have financial to be financially included, those are often the parts that are hardest to bring in. So the difference probably is between that and another country that is also developing, is that they're starting from a much further position behind. And also there's often, in a conflict situation, a lot of distrust between the diaspora. So building that up is really important. For the small states, in a way, it's much easier to define the problem, probably harder to solve it, because small states, yeah, we're talking about countries with less than 2 million population. The challenge is that, by definition, they're small markets. And to get the biggest, the most effective way to get prices down and more efficient services is increased competition. But it's often, if you just look at it, the numbers just don't stack up for most private sector providers, which means you need to have different types of solutions, which are probably around incentives to private sector, subsidies, governments getting involved, and so on. And you look in the South Pacific, the World Bank's doing some quite interesting work there with islands like Samoa and Tonga and so on, in terms of working with the government to try and work with some of the banks that they own to get them to actually offer low cost and efficient services and so on. And I think that's going to have to be one of the ways there. It's a simple matter of economics in many cases, as well as obviously somewhat logistical, because many of the small states just don't have the level of infrastructure. But to me, it's potentially easier to fix as long as you can get enough attention on them. But it's fascinating, really, because we haven't solved the problems for the non-fragile, non-small state. And so we're trying to look at all different circumstances, and there's lots of overlaps, but we really do need specific task forces or focus on the small states and the fragile conflict affected states as well.
Yeah, those are some fascinating issues, and it is vitally important to look at some of these very specific issues faced by small states, you know, like the South Pacific states that you mentioned, states like Tonga are some of the most remittance dependent. So, you know, if we can do something to reduce the costs for them and increase service levels, you know, it can make a huge impact on people's lives. But how is that actually done? You know, you talked about how World Bank and others are working with governments to see how they can encourage industry to provide those services at an affordable cost. But are we just talking about subsidies here, or what else can you really do?
Well, actually, it's interesting because I think the World Bank's doing a really good job in that region as an example. So aside from assistance, you know, the broader assistance that's not really remittance related, about building up the physical digital networks and the infrastructure, physical infrastructure in the country, they're doing things like bringing together all the central banks to try and form a producer utility tool to enable all of them to do their know your customer and other sorts of due diligence. So rather than each entity having to develop their own rules, their own tool, invest in the system and so on, they're doing one across the region, which will then be available to all the different participants in the value chain. So that it will bring the cost down and also bring other utility to the operators. Subsidies do play a part, but also technical assistance is absolutely essential. One of the challenges you see is that there's not enough capacity within the central banks in particular, and then there's the knowledge levels that they have about some of these solutions. So bringing in, I guess, people like you and me to help on a temporary basis, but hopefully training up local people in those organizations to be able to understand and harness a lot of the what's happening in other parts of the world is also absolutely critical. And often I think, although it's easy to say, we don't place enough value on that, but a lot of the work we see is that the a lot of the reason why things aren't as efficient or the regulations aren't as clear or as advanced as we like, it's not because there's a lack of intent. It's just because these institutions have so much work to do anyway, and remittances come some way down the scale, even in remittance-dependent countries. So for me, that's one of the other areas that that can really help make a big difference in this.
Very good points, Leon. I wanted to circle back as well to the point on fragile states, because I think it's an area that a lot, well, especially, you know, linking that with diaspora engagement in humanitarian responses and so on, I think it's an area of focus for a lot of different organizations. I mean, presumably in those fragile contexts, as you've alluded to and described, you know, diaspora remittances, they can really sustain a lot of communities of origin when they're going through crises. And when they're living in states which are already fragile. I mean, beyond, I guess you mentioned one possible solution as parachuting in some sort of team to help regulators during that time. I mean, is there anything else that organizations, you know, actors, anyone else could be doing in those contexts? I mean, I guess states aren't fragile because they choose to be, they're fragile because of various circumstances. So it's one of those challenging situations where you're trying to build infrastructure at all levels. But, you know, is there anything else that you would advise based on your research?
Well, I think so much of our work now comes back to digital. So I think it's a mixture of, it is building that digital infrastructure. It is bringing in expertise, because there's a lot of experts out there to help advise. It is setting up challenge funds in many cases, just to incentivize particularly private sector operators to actually look at these corridors, set themselves up properly, and begin operating. Because, you know, one of the problems, particularly in the conflict cases, is often these are the countries that are on the highest level of concern from a money laundering and terrorist finance viewpoint. And therefore, it's very difficult, for instance, to get private sector companies that aren't from that country to move in, even if they have the product solutions and so on. Because there's sort of this whole chain about, you know, banks are, in particular, they have to provide bank accounts to money transfer companies. And often they won't provide them for companies that are dealing in what are perceived to be dangerous or, you know, places that could cause a problem for that bank. So what it really needs is actually to look not just on the ground in that country, but look in the country where the money's being sent from, where the diasporans are, and tie up both ends of those corridors. So look at very specific initiatives. If I want to send money from country X to country Y, okay, I have to improve a lot in country Y, but I also have to educate stakeholders and government in the other country that actually it's safe to do business there as long as you follow these particular protocols and so on. And it's much more, I think, in having an overall plan and divide it up between the different stakeholders. Then often what happens is that the international bodies will go in, they'll create peace or they'll support in the immediate term, but then they have real difficulty in moving into the medium and longer term solutions. And I think those need to be brought in earlier and really work with the private sector. I think there's so much suspicion often in governments about the motives and the capabilities of the private sector. And on the other side, the private sector moves so fast compared to governments. Private sector says, oh, well, if I can't get this resolved in the short term, I'll go and do something else that I can do right now. And somehow we need to bring those different stakeholders together quite rapidly to develop solutions. It's not normally that there's a lack of solutions. It's normally that it's too difficult for people to understand what's possible. And also there's quite a lot of blockages in the way, so that you really need a hard hitter coming in and clearing that way, I suppose.
Yeah, and presumably you need to de-risk the situation to some degree for the private sector provider to provide those services in fragile / conflict hit countries. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, I guess part of it is the information and the protocols that you've described.
Well, there's probably more than that. I think that's where, in many cases, you do have to provide financial incentives because particularly, if I take my world of remittances, this is by definition at least two countries involved, but many of the private sector operators are operating in 20 plus countries. So they have a lot of different territories to manage. And so for them to start looking at a conflict area that maybe they don't know so much, but where they have the perfect solution, is they're going to need a good reason and often some form of either financial support or some form of technical assistance for them is probably the minimum that will be required. You need the de-risking is partially around knowledge, but I think it's much more around there's a financial risk and there's an opportunity cost related risk as well. If I put my efforts into this country, how do I know it's going to be better for me in the short and long term than just forgetting about that and going to my core countries and working there because I know what I'm doing and I can do a few things differently, but it's much less risky. So I think, for me, unfortunately, it sounds, not a particularly imaginative solution, but that's really the reality that we see. And, when we talk to private sector operators, particularly the fintechs, which, potentially could do really well out of the fragile situations, particularly as new operators or as new systems are being built, they often say, I've got too many other things to do. You really going to have to give me a good reason for doing it. And unfortunately, the humanitarian one doesn't cut it. So then it's normally about volumes or other learnings and so on.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, so we started this podcast by looking at the big picture. And just now we've zoomed into some of the details. And now I'd like to link back to that big picture. We've got 10 more years to reach the 2030 Sustainable Development Goal target to reduce to less than 3% the transaction costs of migrant remittances and eliminate remittance corridors with costs higher than 5%. Big question, but what are the top three things, those critical few areas of action that we all need to focus on?
Well, I suppose we've covered them. I glibly would say digital, but that's not particularly helpful. So I think probably three things for me. One is a joined up approach between all the different stakeholders. And I think particularly the public sector stakeholders, we are seeing at the moment in the post-COVID world, a lot of interest in helping, but I have to say it's not always joined up. So you've either got certain, it's like if you look at where are certain international bodies working on the remittances space, they're all tending to roughly look to the same countries because they all do the same type of analysis on, you know, where are the most remittance dependent countries, which ones are most affected, where's the highest price and so on. And you come to the same types of answers, but then they end up doing things that are basically competing with each other. So there needs to be a lot more coordination at a global level between the different donors so that we get a broader coverage across a number of countries, but actually we get the right things being done and we're not distracting governments. I mean, a lot of these governments in receiving countries, they have a number of different potential donors who are there doing roughly the same thing. I'm not sure they know how to coordinate or manage them. So that's one. Digital, definitely, and within digital, mobile in particular, we haven't talked that much about that, but mobile is the tool that everybody has, whether it's USSD or app-based services. People have it, they understand how to use it. It's becoming cheaper as well. So if we can get cheaper access costs and so on, but mobile to me is somewhere we really have to drive and focus on. And then the final area I think I would sort of put under this whole education piece. We have to really inform the users, the money transfer operators about what's available out there and how to work with governments. And governments, that the money transfer operators and private sector in general are their friends. They're not their enemies. And they really want to work with them. So there's that whole sort of piece of educating. I'm all about sharing best practice. I know you in your work, you do a lot of this and you're trying to look for learnings and so on. The more of that we can do, and with the consumers, so the senders and receivers, really helping to build trust in new services or educating them on how they can decide who to trust, and then linking all of that into not just about how much it costs or how you send from A to B, but what you actually do with your money when it arrives. So much more around the education around how to use finances rather than just what's the best way to send money. Because I'd like to think, you know, in 10 years' time, we've done this conversation here on Zoom over the internet, and it hasn't cost us anything or very little. I'd really like to think that in 10 years' time, a remittance would cost nothing. I think the key is we need to get moving, get to that point as quickly as possible, and then moving forward, talk to people and develop services about what people actually do productively with that money, whether it's investment or helping grow their family finances or whatever, but that we move away, that we're not talking about how much it costs to send a remittance or where you can send it. That's the ubiquitous payment that costs nothing and it's valuable for helping people invest and develop their lives.
Fantastic. Those are some very excellent points. And Leon, you convey a very technical topic in a very clear way that I think most people can understand. And that's quite rare in this industry. And I do refer to you as Mr. Remittances when talking about you. And you have lived up to that name today. You know, I'd like to thank you so much for being on the podcast. Just before we leave each other, how can listeners get in touch? How can they connect with you and DMA?
So great question. So they can connect directly with me on my mobile, which is leon.isaacs@developingmarkets.com, or they can go to our site, which is www.global-dma.com.
Brilliant. We'll leave those links in our show notes. Thank you once again, Leon, for being on the Migration Podcast. You've been an excellent guest and best of luck.
Thanks so much. Really enjoyed it and look forward to hearing others on here as well.
Thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode of the Migration and Diaspora Podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can check out the podcast website at loxanneharley.com/podcast. There, you can subscribe to the mailing list or get in touch if you want to be on the podcast. Be sure to follow the podcast via your favorite podcasting platform and leave a review if you can. Thanks again and see you next time.